There was all sorts of improper redactions. There was things that were redacted that, you know, should not have been. And I had to go, you know, toe-to-toe with the spokesman and the lawyer for the city and the ombudsman in the attorney general's office for these types of things and say, you're not supposed to redact that. I hope readers appreciate that it is an incredibly difficult process. And it took every bit of the last year for us to try to get some of this stuff. And there's a lot of stuff I'm still trying to get.
This is Roughly Speaking Newsroom Edition, the flagship podcast of the Baltimore Sun, featuring stories from our city and our state that you can't get anywhere else. I'm Pamela Wood. Thank you for joining us. Today, we bring back Baltimore Sun reporter Justin Fenton, who released an extensive expose into the corrupt officers in the Gun Trace Task Force and the Baltimore Police Department where they thrived for so long. Justin, welcome to our studio.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about this project. When this story broke a couple of years ago, it was sensational. And we and a lot of other news outlets did a lot of reporting about the charges and the trials and the sentencing. But you wanted to go deeper into the story of Wayne Jenkins and the Gun Trace Task Force. Tell me what you set out to do.
It was clear that there were a lot of tentacles involved in this case, that there was a lot of incidents, there was a lot of misconduct that had stretched back years. And actually, it was a mandate from our publisher, Trifilatsis. He said, you know, we need to do more. We need to try to explore this and explain this to our readers as best we can. And so he told me last year, you know, we were doing story by story and looking into different things. He said, stop, you know, stop and take a break and really, really dive into this and see what you can tell our readers. Our top goal was accountability. We wanted to see if we could find out which commanders specifically, if at all, sort of knew about this stuff or enabled it. And then we wanted to see what else we could uncover, if there were crimes that had occurred or, you know, there was more details to certain things that had come out that we could shed some light on. So it sort of took stock of a universe of allegations, is kind of what I've said. I look at it as almost like a football stadium where every seat is something that they did. And these guys were very productive, making sometimes, you know, hundreds of arrests in a given year. And so there's all these different cases to explore, court records to pull, files to look at, people to talk to. And we just sort of started trying to see what we could find.
And you focused a lot in your series on Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, who led this corrupt Gun Trace Task Force. And you documented years of bad behavior and some red flags that were ignored about his behavior. Tell me about your reporting process. What were some of the ways that you dug into Wayne Jenkins and unearthed this material that we didn't know about before?
I think the easiest thing to do is get lawsuits. I mean, I think, you know, that's something that we cover lawsuits already. We know that that's a place where somebody has decided they're taking the big enough step to sort of formally accuse an officer of doing something in court. So pulled those lawsuits, watched the tapes from the trials, sort of wanted to see how he moved, how he acted in those things, the things he said. Is there a pattern even back then that we could see that continued through today? You know, then going the next level was, you know, talking to those folks, talking to their attorneys, pulling files for maybe cases that didn't escalate into a complaint, but where there's something that happened that can shed some light. I think I saw, you know, there's one case that we have in the story from 2010. It's not a lawsuit, it's not a complaint, but it was a guy who was challenging a drug and gun case where he stood up and he got on the witness stand and just, you know, formally accused Jenkins of lying. This is someone who, you know, defendants don't typically take the stand in their own cases. They don't take the stand and admit to their own wrongdoing in their own cases. I found that extraordinary. And even after he ended up taking a plea because the deck was so stacked against him, he said, I was wrong, but they were wrong. And, you know, this is one of those things that it happens in a courtroom. There's probably nobody in there except the lawyers and the defendant himself. And it goes undocumented, but it existed and it was out there and needed to be found. Another big challenge was trying to talk to people in his orbit. And we have high sourcing standards here at the Sun, and a lot of that didn't make the paper. But I spent a lot of time trying to talk to people who had worked with him, had you know, brushed up against him about sort of what did people know. Because I think there's a belief out there that everybody knew about this, that it was this open secret. Everybody knows Wayne Jenkins is a drug dealer and robbing people. And I wanted to find out from people that I know, people who I feel like will tell me the truth, people maybe who I'm meeting for the first time, you know, is that true? You know, to a T, everybody said they didn't know. And I think that speaks to, that makes sense to me in the idea that if you are committing crimes, you don't want people to know. It's not good for business to have as many people knowing as possible. Do I think that there are perhaps people out there who knew who haven't been brought to account or aren't telling the truth? Absolutely. But the folks I sat down with said this was not something that everybody was sort of whispering about. What they were whispering about was that Jenkins was aggressive, that it was too good to be true that he was getting this many guns. They absolutely say he had a cowboy reputation, and perhaps if people had sort of taken that a step further and looked more closely at him, they might have uncovered these things. But I did not find that it was a widely known thing.
Now, you still had voices from a lot of people in your series who were talking about his behavior. You have one of the fellow cops gave you an interview from jail. You had individuals who were targets, whether they were sort of innocent bystanders caught up in this bad behavior, these questionable traffic stops, or even accused criminals who said that they were stolen from them. How did you get these people to talk to you, or how did you document these stories so you were able to put names and faces to these allegations?
Yeah, like I said about the sourcing standard, it's important for us to be able to quote people on the record. I was very encouraged when Detective Maurice Ward agreed to talk to me. He wanted to help me understand sort of how this stuff happens. That was the biggest question for me, sort of, how does this kind of thing get initiated? Because as I said, where people, it's not good for everyone to know. So how do you sort of raise this idea with somebody? How do you decide to reveal yourself to a fellow officer and say that this is what we're going to do? Or do you want to do this? Are you down with this? Are you in on it? Because if the answer is no, you've just exposed yourself. So he was able to give me some new insight into sort of the process of corruption and into his own. You know, he talked about how the first time he realized he could get away with stuff, he had done a drug arrest. And as he was driving home, he realized he had not submitted the drugs into evidence. And no one ever said anything to him. Now, he realized that if stuff doesn't get submitted, it's not going to become an issue. And you can take stuff. He said that officers were stealing, that officers that he worked with were stealing, and that he did it to fit in, that it was just increased the level of trust among officers, that if we are taking money and, you know, and you take money too, that we're all in on it and we can trust each other. So when he got to work with Jenkins, he thought Jenkins was one of the top cops in the area. He didn't know that he had this history, and he was honored, he said, to be working with him. It took some time, but eventually Jenkins sort of raised the idea of kicking in somebody's door and stealing money from them. And when the opportunity presented itself next, they ended up in the woods splitting up cash.
And now, how many people do you think you talked to or interviewed over the course of your reporting in this series?
Significant in a significant way, really sitting down and talking to people, probably more than 50, 75, something like that. And there's a lot of folks who did not want to talk. You know, a lot of the victims said, I don't want any more trouble. These are both documented and not documented victims. People would mention Sean Souter. You know, there's a belief that he was murdered, that it's a cover-up. And people, I had multiple people say to me, you see what they did to Sean Souter. I'm not going to talk about this. I actually spoke with a man who was a victim who got murdered a few months after I talked to him.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Gregory Harding was robbed by the GTTF in October 2016, and he was a victim of street violence. So, I mean, it's a difficult thing. There's these, you know, the people who are victims are still out there. They have experienced very negative things with the police department, and the idea of sort of coming forward and speaking out had people very nervous. But I did get some people to talk, and they helped me to understand, you know, how these things went down.
So the key person in this whole thing is Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, and you weren't able to talk to him. Explain to me how you tried to go about interviewing him and what happened with that.
So many letters, a lot of phone calls to his attorney, reached out to his family. Again, trying to reach out to a lot of people in his orbit so that even if I couldn't speak to him, I had a three-dimensional view of who he was, what sort of makes him tick, you know, hoping that maybe the word would get back to him that I was doing all these interviews and that I was asking questions that were fair and trying to get to the truth of the matter. You know, I don't know that people have been able to explain what caused this to happen to him, and that's a question I still want to be able to answer. But what I could do was try to get every recording of him I could get, every person that I could find who has spent time with him, and try to understand him from their perspective. Early on, I put a whiteboard up in the office. They gave me an empty office, and I put a whiteboard up, and I was trying to explore all the different connections. It was overwhelming. It kind of looked like going to one of those conspiracy boards from like Homeland or something, drawing connections between people, because there is a tremendous amount of overlap where like officers are working with officers who have been accused of misconduct, and then like, you know, this guy worked with this guy in 2006, and this guy was accused of doing the same, you know, entering a home without a warrant. We're trying to like sort of wrap our arms around this, again, this universe of complaints, this universe of misconduct. There have been various plainclothes scandals over the years where officers were accused of taking money that did not get this type of attention, that did not lead to criminal charges. So I explored those cases to try to understand sort of, well, what were they doing then? What was their MO? Do they have any connections to this group? So there's a lot of stuff that went into this that didn't end up making the story, but was part of my, you know, education of police misconduct. The Sun's written stories about this stuff for years and years and years. I mean, a lot of the stuff I knew about because it's in our clips. We've written about it. But going in depth in this kind of way, I think it was something that was important for us to do a comprehensive story. I think was an attempt to try to really drive it home and help people understand it in a different kind of way.
Now, one part of your series that really struck me was about a man named Saren Gay. He was an innocent bystander, really, who got caught up in this. And to recap what happened to him, in the summer of 2016, Wayne Jenkins' team was chasing a car downtown, and that car slammed into Mr. Gay's car. Now, you tracked him down and found out he was being sued by the guy who had slammed into him, and you pieced together what had really happened. Tell me how that played out.
Yeah, so at the officer's trial last year, they played audio from a secret microphone that was hidden in one of the officer's cars. So in August 2016, the officers had tried to stop a guy at a gas station, probably for a seatbelt violation, who knows, but he took off. He was spooked, and he ends up getting into a car crash. So the audio from the microphone that was played, so the officer's hanging back, sort of talking about, should we leave? Do you think anyone will know we were here? Should we help? Should we show up and say that, hey, we just happened upon this and we're going to help? And the officers ultimately decide, let's just get out of here. They say the guy's unconscious. He's not going to say anything. Let's get out of here. Let's change our time card so no one even knows we were working. I couldn't shake that story because I wondered what happened to those guys in the car. You know, are they okay? Do they know what happened to them? And so, you know, trying to piece together what is available, I got the police reports for the crash that identified the occupants of the vehicle. And so then we ran the people's names through Case Search just to see what we could see. And it turned out there was a lawsuit that had been filed over the crash involving the two cars. But the names were reversed. We were very confused. The person who had hit the one car was suing the other guy. It appeared as though the person fleeing the officers was suing the person who he struck who was not involved. I was very confused by this. So I kept trying to get as many different things that I could. I ended up getting video of the crash. And when I reached out to the lawyer for the man who was being sued, I said, you know, this shows your client was struck. Like, why is he being sued?
Right.
Like, this doesn't make any sense. And the lawyer told me that he hadn't been able to get that video, that he had asked for it, and they told him there was no video. I was able to get it. I was able to show this gentleman for the first time that there was evidence corroborating what happened to him, and the lawsuit got dropped. It was an interesting experience, though, because, I mean, he was so sort of bewildered by this whole thing. I sat him down and told him, are you aware that the dirty cops, you know, chasing people, initiated this crash and then took off without helping? And he just sort of stared at me because, you know, saying that to somebody who's been experiencing this for over a year, you know, he didn't even know how to react. But I was happy that the lawsuit was dropped because he shouldn't have been sued.
My light was green and his light was red. So I was in the hospital. I was having a pain everywhere, neck, back pain. My car was towed away, but that was a total lost car, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine it being kind of unbelievable from his perspective. Like, that sounds like something out of a movie, but that was playing out on our streets, you know, day after day with this crew. One of the things you relied on a lot was body camera footage, which, you know, is a recent addition here in Baltimore. How much body camera footage did you watch, and how important was that to the reporting process?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that corrupt officers for a time period had videos recording their movements is invaluable, and it's too bad that only two officers had them for most of the period covered here. And of course, they didn't document the really bad stuff that they were doing, although I think that speaks to the limitations of the body cameras. But anyway, yeah, we asked the department for as much footage as we could get. I asked first for a log of all times that they had footage, and then I started asking for that footage. Initially, you know, they don't make it easy. You know, you have to wait a long time to get this stuff, and they charge a lot of money for it. So, you know, initially I was sort of trying to be strategic about it, but over time I sort of started saying, you know, give me everything, and we're entitled to see this stuff. This is something the public has to see, and I think we were able to get just about everything. Again, it was instructive, not in showing some crime that should have been caught, but really showing the type of conduct I think that the officers thought was okay. I mean, we talk about these seatbelt stops they were doing, sort of stopping people all over for seatbelt stops, then tearing through their cars. You know, they put that on camera.
Usually wear your seatbelt?
Yeah.
Is there a reason you didn't have it on today?
I had my seatbelt on.
Sir, do you wear your seatbelt?
Yeah.
You don't have your seatbelt on. Why don't you have a seatbelt on? Do you usually wear
your
seatbelt?
I wear my seatbelt every day. I just got hit in the car.
Just one second. I got you, but you pulled out of pumps, correct?
No, sir. I was getting mad.
How you doing, man? How come you don't got a seatbelt on?
Man, we just came out the gas station.
they believed that was okay. They didn't put on camera when they were taking money. They knew that was wrong. They thought this was okay. And I think that, that helps us to understand the culture of the department.
Now, when you were trying to dig up all this material, the lawsuits, body camera footage, surveillance video, were there any obstacles in your reporting? Were there things you were trying to get that were you were blocked from accessing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we should mention the leaked documents. I mean, I got leaked internal affairs reports. You know, those are things that are not supposed to see the light of day. The state legislature keeps it that way. It's not unique to Baltimore City. It's not unique to police. Documents related to internal investigations are secret, and there have been efforts to make them not secret, like many states like Florida and Ohio and different states that have an open approach to that kind of stuff. The only way I could get that stuff was through leaks. And they are incredibly revealing. You know, there are transcripts, reports, things that we wouldn't have been able to get. You know, again, I'm trying to think. Public records requests in the state are not easy. There's a 30-day limit where the government's supposed to turn it over, and nobody ever follows that.
Yes, almost never.
Never. And I mean, it's crazy. I waited 8 months to get emails belonging to the prior sergeant of the Gun Trace Task Force, Thomas Allers. 8 months. And it wasn't that many emails. There was all sorts of improper redactions. There was things that were redacted that, you know, should not have been. And I had to go, you know, toe-to-toe with the spokesman and the lawyer for the city and the ombudsman in the attorney general's office for these types of things and say, you're not supposed to redact that. I hope readers appreciate that it is an incredibly difficult process. And it took every bit of the last year for us to try to get some of this stuff. And there's a lot of stuff I'm still trying to get.
So one of the tools you used in your reporting was going back and looking at past trials. And, you know, we don't have cameras in the courtroom. You can't record with your cell phone, but there are recordings made by the court itself. And anybody can go and check these out. Tell me about how that was a tool in your reporting, but also some of the limitations on that.
Yeah, I mean, as our data reporting showed, a lot of Wayne Jenkins cases were being thrown out before they even made it to court. But one of the things I thought would be instructive was to look at cases that were contested, cases that did go to either a motions hearing or there was a trial where there was a challenge that was being made, and sort of see what exactly they were alleging, how the judges reacted, how the prosecutors conducted themselves, and how the officers obviously conducted themselves. And you know, it was interesting to see some cases where the judges would say the officers violated people's rights, but they would like almost always sort of add at the end, like, but I don't want you guys to get discouraged, and like, but don't take it personally. Like, you're doing a good job out there. You know, I think that speaks to, you know, again, this the fog that's around this stuff and the atmosphere of permissibility that exists. But in terms of bringing those recordings to people, yeah, the court has this tough rule about not being able to, even though it occurs in public, it's a public hearing that you can go to. Even though there's a recording that exists that you can watch, you can't show it to anybody outside of that courthouse. There is currently a lawsuit being brought by some independent journalists, a former City Paper journalists in conjunction with the Georgetown Law Clinic, where they're trying to fight it. They're saying this is not right. But now there's this different challenge being brought to sort of say this shouldn't be allowed at all. Like, we're not even going to try to change the law. We're just going to try to strike down the law. And I support them 100%. I think people should see these videos. Yeah.
And if we had that ability, we would be able to play clips here on this podcast.
So absolutely.
We'd be able to put it
insert
on.
Insert the clip right here. Yeah.
Yeah. Or put it on our website, and then people can hear and see for themselves and make their own judgment. But right now we're precluded from doing that.
Yeah. I mean, it's especially frustrating. I mean, these are long adjudicated cases. You know, there's nothing pending. There's nothing that's going to disrupt. We're not talking about witnesses and people who are in danger. We're talking about, you know, public employees, police officers, prosecutors, judges, and how they act in court. You know, going back years, it's kind of ridiculous.
And these were all closed cases that
Absolutely.
We're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the cases have been overturned. People have been either exonerated or the convictions have been wiped away. It's about the officers. So, yeah, it's frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this series is a little different from standard stories in our online presentation on our website. It was given some special treatment. Tell me how that came together.
Yeah, I want to thank the Pulitzer Center, who provided some grant funding to help us make this sort of bring up the level of the presentation here. In this day and age, news organizations signal to the reader that a story is important by giving it a really good layout and a good look, a good interactivity. And I think we're able to do that with the help of the Pulitzer Center.
Yeah, it's really quite fantastic looking. So I encourage everyone to check out Justin's series, BaltimoreSun.com. So, Justin, you've put in a tremendous amount of work on this series. What comes next for you in this story?
I think there's more to be said about this. I think the state commission is going to keep doing its investigation. I think there's lawsuits that are still playing out. There could be more charges. I'm going to keep covering those things. I'm also going to be taking some time from the paper to pursue this story and this whole, all these things that happened over this intense 3 or 4 year period between Freddie Gray and the riots and the Gun Trace Task Force, the death death of Sean Suter and wrap it up into a book that I'm writing for Random House, and that'll be published sometime in the next year.
Oh, well, we look forward to reading that and more of your work. Justin, thank you again for joining us and talking about your process in digging up all this information.
Okay, thank you.
And that wraps up this week's Newsroom Edition. Thank you for joining us. For more audio from the Baltimore Sun, head on over to baltimoresun.com/roughlyspeaking or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to check us out every Friday. And as we say each week, as times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please consider subscribing at baltimoresun.com/subscribe. For producers Hallie Miller and Steve Early, thanks again, and we'll see you back here next week.